content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we'll continue reading from the combined edition of The Week magazine, dated December 28, 2012, to January 4th, 2013, and a happy new year to you, too. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. We will have quite a few articles about the year in review from 2012 that I think you'll enjoy. We'll take a look at the health and science section and a review of what happened in 2012 in the health and science field. But we'll begin with pulling from some online material that is fresh, big news after all of the activity around the so-called fiscal cliff here. At 11 o'clock on New Year's Day, 11 p.m., that is, the House cleared a Senate compromise to pull the American economy back onto the ledge of the fiscal cliff, raising marginal tax rates for households earning $450,000 or more, extending unemployment benefits and a series of tax breaks for low-income and middle-class workers, and pushing back a scheduled series of deliberately punitive spending cuts for 2 months. It wasn't a pretty resolution to an ugly fight, but it likely kept the country from careening into another recession and prevented a big tax increase for more than 98% of taxpayers. Miffed House Republicans almost sunk the deal, and some liberals are upset that President Obama didn't use his leverage to exact more concessions from the GOP. But almost everyone agrees that another big fight is looming in the wings. Technically, the question of who won the fiscal cliff won't be answered until we know what happens when Congress reaches the debt ceiling in a month or two, says Ezra Klein at the Washington Post. But it's not too early to look at who won round one of the fiscal cliff fight. Here is a look at who came out smiling and who is grimacing after the fiscal cliff battle. First, we'll take a look at the winners. President Obama. Obama welcomed the House's passage of the compromise bill, said he hoped the next bipartisan deal could be hammered out with a little bit less drama, a little less brinksmanship, and not scare the heck out of folks quite as much. Then he boarded Air Force One for Hawaii to finish his Christmas vacation. By forcing Republicans to support raising taxes on the wealthy, despite years of fervent promises, says Howard Kurtz at the Daily Beast, Obama clearly won the fiscal cliff skirmish. It isn't the grand bargain Obama was hoping for, says Andrew Sullivan at the Daily Beast, but what he's getting, which is a gradual shift toward more fiscal responsibility, with key protections for the working poor and the unemployed in place, is all he really wants for right now. He faces some big fights with the rabid Republican House, but this was an important step in the right direction. And sometimes the little advances are preferable, under certain circumstances, to big breakthroughs. The next winner was Joe Biden. Biden certainly emerges with enhanced stature from the budget mess, says the Daily Beast's Kurtz. He was called off the bench on Sunday, then showed a deft hand and the experience of growing up in the Senate, in quickly hammering out a deal with Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. If the 70-year-old vice president decides to run for Obama's job in 2016, such performances could more than offset his reputation for shooting from the lip. Of course, if Democrats end up hating the deal, this could actually bite Biden down the line, says Chris Saliza at the Washington Post. But he clearly ranks among the winners for negotiating the deal and persuading Democrats to support it. The vice president is often underestimated by the political press, but the Biden as major White House asset storyline writes itself now. Mitch McConnell, also a winner, the Senate minority leader, stayed behind the scenes, as is his preference, for almost the entirety of the fiscal cliff debate. But after House Republicans proved unable to move the needle, he stepped in to save the party, says Saliza. The GOP would have shouldered the blame for sending us over the cliff, a sure political loser. As a bonus, everybody now knows that the Republican who can get things done is in the upper chamber of Congress. But McConnell's deal-making may not endear him to his House GOP colleagues. While he and other Senate Republicans rather presciently became convinced that House conservatives would sink the economy and their party rather than support a bipartisan compromise, says Politico, some House Republicans mistrust McConnell more than they do Obama or Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. They aren't wild about the deal or sure of McConnell's fiscal conservatism, but they are confident they always know where Democrats stand. The rich and elderly were winners in the whole issue as well. Obama's decision to raise the threshold for higher taxes from $250,000 to $450,000 makes for a big tax cut for all kinds of rich people, not just those with adjusted gross incomes between the two figures, says Matthew Iglesias at Slate. Because our tax rates are marginal, meaning that only income above $450,000 is taxed at the higher rate, if you make $600,000 or even $1 million a year, you still have a very large share of your income that's taxed at a lower rate thanks to this deal. The deal also didn't have any of the expected cuts to Social Security and other federal retirement security programs. So at least for now, old people are the winners too. And now the losers from the whole fiscal cliff debacle here. The deficit. Well, remember, Congress engineered the fiscal cliff to force ambitious budget reform to shrink America's yawning budget deficit, says the Washington Post in an editorial. Instead, the small, imperfect package that lawmakers eked out will do too little to address the nation's long-term debt problem. In fact, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the deal adds $3.9 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. To be fair, the $4 trillion price tag is against the baseline, which assumed the expiration of all tax cuts. So naturally, undoing those tax increases was going to add a lot to the deficit, says Joe Wiesenthal at Business Insider. But creating an artificial political crisis like this was the best chance yet to secure a grand bargain of big tax hikes and major spending cuts to tackle the deficit, says Slate's Iglesias. It flopped, handing a catastrophic defeat for the grand bargain. The next loser, John Boehner. The fiscal cliff talks were cast as a moment for John Boehner to cement his legacy as Speaker, negotiating a grand bargain that would set the country on the first financial course through the Republican-controlled House, says Saliza at the Washington Post. The exact opposite happened. The Ohio Republican dropped negotiations with Obama to pass his own Plan B, raising taxes on only people earning $1 million a year. But that plan failed to even get a vote, raising questions about how much, if any, control he had over his fellow House Republicans. That idea was reinforced when Boehner couldn't get more than half of his caucus, or even his top lieutenants, to back the final compromise, says Daniel Neuhauser at Roll Call. Boehner now slumps into the 113th Congress with gavel firmly in hand, but with scant ability to wield its power. The next losers were the Tea Partiers and conservatives. If the deal was bad for Boehner, it was worse for the conservative members of his caucus, who failed to derail it. The 153-page bill was written only the day before by Washington insiders working in the dark of night and crammed with giveaways and legislative spare parts, says David Farenthold, Rosalind Helderman, and Ed O'Keefe at the Washington Post. It was too rushed, too bloated, too secretive, too expensive, and it will raise taxes but do relatively little to cut government spending or the massive federal deficit. In other words, for the Tea Party-influenced crop of House Republicans, this bill is everything they had wanted to change about the way Washington worked. And it's not their first disappointment, says David Weigel at Slate. Time and again, Washington is shocked by this well-known fact. But House Republicans believe all of that stuff they tell their conservative audiences. And they did win their majority in 2010 by promising never to raise taxes and to take a samurai sword to the budget. Neither goal has panned out. This is a complete surrender on everything for conservatives, columnist Charles Krauthammer said on Fox News. The next losers were Hurricane Sandy victims. After the messy fight over the fiscal cliff bill, House GOP leaders canceled a scheduled vote on a supplemental spending bill for areas ravaged by Hurricane Sandy, mostly in New York and New Jersey. The House Appropriations Committee had even teed up a $60 billion package matching the Sandy relief bill that passed the Senate last week. Absent a change of heart, the upshot now is that the Senate bill will die with this Congress on Thursday at noon, says David Rogers at Politico. I assume there is as tactical consideration here that the Republican leadership didn't want to be anywhere near a big spending bill after the fiasco of their handling the tax debate, says Representative Bob Andrews, a Democrat from New Jersey. I understand the tactics, but there is a real human need here that is being ignored. And the next big loser was Grover Norquist. The fiscal cliff deal has to be a hard pill to swallow for Norquist, the influential head of anti-tax group Americans for Tax Reform. Norquist isn't the tax-squelching Svengali some pundits have painted him to be, but his particular gimmick, a pledge to never cast an affirmative vote for higher taxes, had become influential on its own terms, says Slate's Iglesias. The White House and other pro-deal Democrats see breaking this taboo as an important precedent setter in its own right. Norquist did take to Twitter to give his blessing to the deal, saying every Republican voting for Senate bill is cutting taxes and keeping his or her pledge. Now, from the Week magazine, let's take a look at a review of the year 2012. We'll do it month by month, beginning in January of 2012. As election year begins, this is last January, of course, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney wins the New Hampshire primary. Romney is considered the frontrunner for the GOP nomination, but has yet to win over the party's conservative base, which continues to view him as an untrustworthy closet moderate. Romney is still facing credible challenges from Rick Santorum, the socially conservative, sweater vest-wearing former senator, and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Near an island off the west coast of Italy, the Italian cruise ship Costa Concordia runs aground and partially capsizes. At least 30 passengers drown after a bungled rescue and evacuation of more than 4,200 passengers and crew. The ship's captain, Francesco Centino, is charged with numerous maritime offenses, including leaving the ship before passengers. He claims to have tripped and fallen into the lifeboat that carried him to safety. Romney's post-New Hampshire momentum is extinguished when Gingrich crushes him in the South Carolina primary by 12 points after he attacks Romney as a predatory capitalist who got rich gutting companies. And that was January of last year. Now let's take a look at what happened in February. Singer Whitney Houston drowns at the age of 48 in a bathtub at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles after suffering a cardiac event caused by a long cocaine abuse. In a gated community outside Orlando, a 17-year-old black teenager, Trayvon Martin, is shot and killed by George Zimmerman, 28, a neighborhood watch coordinator, after the two engage in a violent struggle. Prior to the shooting, Zimmerman calls police to say he suspects the hoodie-wearing Martin of being up to no good, though Martin is merely returning to his father's house after purchasing iced tea and Skittles. The case sparks a national debate over hoodies and racial profiling. Now, the month of March 2012, here's what happened. In Kandahar, Afghanistan, a U.S. soldier, Sergeant Robert Bales, slips out of his base under cover of darkness and, in a two-hour rampage, allegedly murders 16 Afghan civilians in their homes, setting fire to some of the bodies. Mitt Romney cleans up in the Super Tuesday round of national primaries, but still struggles to connect with more conservative voters, as Santorum wins primaries in Alabama and Mississippi, with Gingrich coming second in each. If you're the front runner and you keep coming in third, Gingrich acidly remarks of Romney, you're not much of a front runner. Now, let's see what happened during the month of April in 2012. With his campaign out of money, Santorum suspends his presidential campaign, all but guaranteeing Romney's eventual victory in Florida. A special prosecutor charges George Zimmerman with second-degree murder and Trayvon Martin's death. A blind human rights activist, Chen Guangcheng, escapes house arrest in China and takes refuge in the U.S., in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, sparking a tense diplomatic standoff that ends when Chen is allowed to flee to the U.S. North Korea test fires a long-range missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, but the missile disintegrates shortly after takeoff, dealing a blow to new leader Kim Jong-un's efforts to fill the platform shoes of his father, the late Kim Jong-il. During the centenary commemoration of the sinking of the Titanic, young Twitter users expressed shock at learning that the film Titanic was based on a real event. "How am I just finding this out?" tweets one young woman. In May of 2012, Edvard Munch's iconic painting The Scream sells in New York for a record $120 million. Newt Gingrich suspends his presidential campaign, and Mitt Romney officially clinches the GOP nomination with victory in the Texas primary. Obama becomes the first U.S. president to state his support for gay marriage, saying that his views on the issue have evolved. In France's presidential election, voters weary of unemployment and austerity measures brought on by the euro crisis booed out Nicolas Sarkozy and elect the Socialist Party François Hollande. Austerity needs not be Europe's fate, says Hollande, who later makes good on a vow to raise France's top tax rate to 75%. In June of 2012, here's what happened. In Britain, Queen Elizabeth II celebrates 60 years on the throne with a pageant of nautical vessels down the River Thames and a concert featuring Sir Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder, who serenades the Queen with "Isn't She Lovely?" In Egypt, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood is elected president in the country's first democratic election since the fall of dictator Hosni Mubarak in 2011. To the deep dismay of conservatives, the Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act in a 5-4 decision. Chief Justice John Roberts casts a surprising deciding vote, ruling that the ACA's controversial individual mandate is in effect just a simple tax on the uninsured and thus constitutional under Congress's broad taxing power. During the month of July in 2012, the Olympic Games begin in London with a lavish and surreal opening ceremony in which a stuntman dressed as the Queen parachutes out of a helicopter. American swimmer Michael Phelps wins his 19th career gold medal, becoming the most decorated Olympian in history. Scientists at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva announced the discovery of a new subatomic particle they say is consistent with the legendary Higgs boson they've been hunting for half a century, solving a key mystery of physics. In Aurora, Colorado, James Holmes, 24, a loner with a history of psychiatric problems, goes on a shooting rampage in a movie theater with a semi-automatic rifle equipped with a 100-round magazine, killing 12 and wounding 58. In Moscow, members of the Pussy Riot, an all-girl punk rock band, go on trial in Moscow for performing an unauthorized concert inside a Russian Orthodox church, with lyrics strongly critical of Russian President Vladimir Putin and the church. A South Korean rapper, Psy, releases the video of his latest single, Gangnam Style. The oddly compelling video, in which the chubby 34-year-old performs a peculiar horse-riding dance at various locations around Seoul, instantly becomes a YouTube sensation around the world with millions of views. Now let's take a look at what happened in August of 2012. In Russia, three members of Pussy Riot are sentenced to 2 years in jail for hooliganism. In Syria, where war has been raging all year between government forces and opponents of dictator Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian army massacres hundreds of civilians in the suburbs of Damascus and in the city of Hama. At the Olympics, sprinter Usain Bolt wins his second consecutive gold in both the 100 and 200 meters, a feat unprecedented in Olympic history. U.S. cyclist Lance Armstrong, the winner of a record 7 Tour de France, announces he won't contest charges by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency that he used banned substances throughout his cycling career. Mitt Romney chooses Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan to be his running mate. At the Republican Party convention in Tampa, Ryan delivers a widely praised speech, as does Romney's wife, Ann. Stealing the show, however, is film legend Clint Eastwood, 82 years old, who uses his keynote address to deliver his complaints to an imaginary President Obama in an empty wooden chair. In September of 2012, at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, Bill Clinton rouses delegates and a national TV audience with a forceful defense of President Obama's record in digging the country out of a deep economic hole and a withering attack on what he calls Romney's winner-take-all philosophy. Obama's post-convention bounce leaves him with the lead of 5 to 7 points. In violent demonstrations across the Arab world, angry crowds protest innocence of Muslims, an anti-Islamic YouTube video by a Christian Egyptian immigrant in California. More than 40 die in the protests. In Benghazi, Libya, a local terrorist group attacks the U.S. consulate with rocket-propelled grenades and machine gun fire, killing U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three others. A European magazine publishes topless photos of Kate Middleton, wife of Britain's Prince William, sunbathing on vacation. Romney's campaign suffers a major blow with the release of a video secretly recorded at a fundraising dinner, in which he tells wealthy donors that no matter how hard he campaigns, there are 47% of people who will vote for the president no matter what, because they rely on government handouts and see themselves as victims. Romney adds, "My job is not to worry about those people." In October of 2012, entering the first presidential debate, Romney desperately needs a game-changing performance, and he delivers one. Speaking with passion and authority, Romney portrays himself as a moderate who will not cut taxes on the rich and will defend the middle class and work with Democrats. Obama seems tired, distracted, and aloof, and spends much of the evening on the defensive, looking down at his lectern. Even liberal pundits called it one of the worst debate performances in presidential history. Within days, Obama's lead in the polls evaporates. Syrian warplanes and artillery began a brutal bombardment of the city of Homs. A massive superstorm, Hurricane Sandy, makes a direct hit on the New York metropolitan area in October. And the storm surge and fierce winds devastate coastal areas of New York and New Jersey. More than 110 people die, most of them by drowning, and much of the region is left without power, in some communities for weeks. In November of 2012, as Americans go to the polls to choose a president, conservative pundits insist that polls showing Obama with a decisive advantage in swing states are wrong and that the momentum is with Romney. The pollsters, however, turn out to be correct, and Obama is elected to a second term, winning 332 electoral votes and 51% of the popular vote, while Mitt Romney ends up with only 206 electoral votes and 47% of the vote. In a post-election call to donors, Romney blames his defeat on what he calls generous gifts Obama handed out to voters, especially the African-American community, the Hispanic community, and young people. In Maine, Maryland, and Washington State, voters legalize same-sex marriage. CIA Director David Petraeus steps down after admitting to an extramarital affair with his biographer Paula Broadwell, acknowledging extremely poor judgment. The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, who is under consideration to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, comes under fire by Republicans for initially describing the Benghazi attack as a spontaneous response by extremists to an anti-Islam video, not a planned attack by an al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist. Senator John McCain calls Rice not very bright. And in December of 2012, Prince William and Kate Middleton confirm that they are expecting their first child after Kate is admitted to the hospital suffering from severe morning sickness. In a prank that turns tragic, a pair of Australian disc jockeys pretending to be Britain's Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles call the hospital asking for an update on Kate's condition. The nurse who accepts their call later commits suicide. In Oregon, 22-year-old Jacob Tyler Roberts charges into a mall jammed with 10,000 Christmas shoppers and opens fire with an AR-15 assault rifle, killing two and gravely injuring one before killing himself. As Gangnam Style closes in on its billionth viewing, a video surfaces of Psy at a 2004 South Korean anti-war demonstration exhorting fans to kill those Yankees. Psy apologizes, saying he was very upset by civilian deaths in Iraq. In Washington, President Obama and House Republicans entered tense negotiations on a plan to avoid the fiscal cliff of automatic tax hikes and spending cuts due to take effect on January 1. Another mass shooting, this one in Connecticut, horrifies the nation. Troubled loner Adam Lanza, who is 20 years old, uses his mother's semi-automatic assault rifle to massacre 20 elementary school children and 6 adults. Even some congressmen with pro-gun records, such as Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, talk of the need for common-sense gun control laws. The mass murder of babies, Manchin says, has changed me, and it's changed most of Americans, I would think. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here, the first week of January 2013. Thanks so much for joining me. We are taking a look back today at some of the events that happened in 2012. Right now, we're going to look at a poll watch which describes the way we were in 2012. We're starting to feel a bit more optimistic, but we still have plenty of worries and gripes. Here's how the polls line up on some of these different subjects. How are we feeling? Not great, but we're getting better. In October of this past year, 42% of Americans said the country was heading in the right direction, the highest number in almost 3 years. That was according to an ABC News and Washington Post poll. And 61% thought the economy was either in recovery or would be soon. 56% are optimistic that President Obama will be able to reduce unemployment in his second term. 55% say he'll improve the health care system, and 54% think he'll oversee a strong economic recovery. Not everyone is so confident about the nation's future, however. 31% say the challenges facing the country are so serious that America might not be able to overcome them. 40% worry that the U.S. is evolving into a socialist state. And 57% think America is on the decline as a civilization. Now, the next question about how we were in 2012, what is bugging us? Partisan politics. 21% say President Obama makes them feel angry. 49% of Republicans think Acorn stole the election, even though the community organizing group closed in 2010. 85% believe the two parties should compromise some of their positions to break the deadlock in Washington. But when it comes to specific policy disputes, few Americans want to meet halfway. Just 41% would compromise on the budget deficit, while only 34% would reach across the aisle on immigration and 33% on health care reform. The next question is, how has society changed? We are increasingly gay-friendly. 53% approve of same-sex marriage, an all-time high. 61% say gay and lesbian couples should be allowed to adopt children. And 91% of gays and lesbians report that their communities have become more accepting of their sexuality in recent years. Attitudes on recreational drugs are also changing. 82% believe the U.S. is losing the war on drugs, and 58% support the legalization of marijuana. Do we have any other vices? Our smartphones. 50% of Americans now own one of these gadgets, and 58% of that group check it at least once every hour, often at inappropriate times. 30% have used their phones during a meal with others, 39% while in the bathroom, and 9% during a religious service. Given the choice, 21% would rather give up sex than their cell phones. We're also glued to social media, with Internet users spending more than 2 billion hours a month on sites like Facebook and Twitter, and that is up 37% from 2011. Not all social media users are very social, though. 18% say they're blocked, unfriended, or hidden a fellow user because of offensive political postings. And finally, in this poll watch entitled The Way We Were in 2012, the last question is, what are we scared of? Just about everything. 66% are concerned about global warming. 35% fear a loss of privacy if the police begin using unmanned aerial drones. 59% are worried about becoming a victim of identity theft. And 65% believe another 9/11-style attack is likely in the next decade. That could explain why 30% of Americans are willing to endure a body cavity search in order to fly on a commercial airliner, and 35% are prepared to wear electric shock bracelets that would allow airport officials to incapacitate potential terrorists. 12% of Americans also believe the Mayan apocalypse would end the world on December 21st. If the apocalypse did occur, 17% of men said they'd like to spend their final moments with Jennifer Aniston, while 23% of women would take comfort in the arms of George Clooney. And that is the way we were in 2012, according to Poll Watch in The Week magazine. now let's take a look at the Health and Science section in the Week magazine for this issue that was dated December 28, 2012 through January 4, 2013. Here are some of the things they said were good for us and some of the things we were told to avoid. First of all, some of the things they said were good for us. Acupuncture can ease your pain. New research shows that the ancient Chinese healing technique, which involves sticking needles into specific points in the body to encourage the flow of QI, or energy, through unseen pathways, often works better than over-the-counter remedies. About 50% of people who have migraines, arthritis, and chronic back or joint pain reported feeling significantly better after undergoing acupuncture, compared with 30% of people who tried traditional remedies. Doctors still don't understand how acupuncture works, says Andrew Vickers of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, but they now have firm evidence that it's an effective treatment for chronic pain. Here's something else that said to be good for us. Arguing with your parents as a teenager trains you to reject peer pressure. University of Virginia researchers observed more than 150 13-year-olds as they disputed issues like grades and chores with their mothers. Checking back in with the teens several years later, they discovered that those who had argued the longest and most convincingly, without yelling or whining, were also 40% less likely to have accepted offers of drugs and alcohol than the teens who were required to simply obey their mothers. Study author Joseph P. Allen says constructive debates with parents are a critical training ground for independent decision-making. Also under the things that were good for us category, adding spices to meals can hike your metabolism and improve your heart health. Penn State University researchers prepared identical high-fat meals for two groups of volunteers, then added a mix of spices, including rosemary, oregano, and cinnamon, to the meal of one group. Eating rich foods typically increases blood levels of insulin and triglyceride fats, which heighten the risk of diabetes and heart disease. Volunteers eating the spicy meal saw increases in triglycerides and insulin that were 31% and 21% lower, respectively, than those of the group who ate the blander offering. Study author Sheila West suspects the antioxidants in spices are responsible. What else is good for us? Working your core can give you sexual pleasure if you're a woman. Among women who experience orgasms triggered by exercise alone, no partner, toys, or even sexual thoughts needed, 51% said that their first coregasm happened during an abs workout. Though rumors of the coregasm have existed in fitness circles for years, exercise-induced orgasm is something we really know nothing about, not scientifically, says study author Debbie Hermanick. She says her findings, while still exploratory, could help decode the physical processes that underlie women's sexual pleasure. What else is good for us? Popcorn protects you from cancer and heart disease. Tests of several popcorn brands reveal that the hulls, the tough fragments that often stick in your teeth, contain surprisingly high levels of disease-fighting antioxidants called polyphenols. One serving of popcorn packs more than twice the polyphenols that a similar serving of most fruits and vegetables does, though popcorn lacks key vitamins. Study author Joe Vinson says that popcorn hulls, which are also rich in fiber, are nutritional gold nuggets that make popcorn the perfect snack food as long as you air pop it and hold the salt and the butter. What else is good for us, according to The Week magazine? Circumcision reduces the risk of sexually transmitted diseases. A review of male circumcision research found that the medical benefits outweigh the risks of the procedure, says pediatric bioethicist Douglas DeKima. Circumcised infants are 90% less likely than uncircumcised ones to develop urinary tract infections, and later in life they're at lower risk of contracting HIV, herpes, penile cancer, and human papillomavirus, which when passed to female partners can cause cervical cancer. Serious complications occur in only about 0.2% of babies who undergo circumcision. Another medical procedure that's good for us is castration, an even better way to a longer life. Korean researchers studied the genealogical records of boys castrated to serve in the palace of the Joseon Dynasty between the late 14th and the early 20th centuries, and they found that they lived up to 19 years longer than their peers. They were also 130 times more likely to reach the age of 100 than people in developed countries are today. The findings support the idea that male sex hormones decrease the lifespan of men, the study authors write. In contrast to estrogen, which appears to enhance longevity, testosterone seems to weaken the immune system and increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And now, here are some of the things that we were told to avoid in the year 2000, and this 2012, that is, and this is from the Health and Science section of the week. The first thing to avoid, being rich makes you more likely to lie, cheat, and steal. A series of experiments conducted on volunteers with annual incomes ranging between $16,000 and $150,000 found that the wealthiest were most likely to cheat to win a $50 prize, take candy from children, and pocket extra change given to them by mistake. Drivers of pricier cars were also four times more likely than those who drove cheaper models to cut off other drivers and pedestrians. Being wealthy seems to insulate you from the outside world and makes you less likely to perceive the impact that your behavior has on others, says study author Paul Piff. Sleeping in on the weekends can make you fat. A German study found that a person's odds of being overweight increase 33% for every hour of difference between their weekday and weekend sleep schedules. Two out of three people effectively commute between two time zones each week, disrupting their circadian rhythms. That social jet lag leads them to eat at times when the body doesn't want to eat or isn't prepared for digesting food properly, thus leading to weight gain, says study author Till Ronenberg. Something else we're told to avoid is too much exercise. It may hurt you more than it helps. While being a runner lowers your risk of early death by nearly 20% over not running, running more than 20 miles per week appears to cancel out that benefit. Jogging slowly decreases mortality risk, whereas running at a pace faster than 8 minutes a mile has been found to put extra stress on the heart. Studies have shown that more than an hour of intense aerobic activity per day can cause serious heart problems, including scarring, an irregular heartbeat, and clogged arteries. Many people wrongly assume that if moderate exercise is good, then more is better, says study author James O'Keefe. But beyond an hour, you reach a point of diminishing returns. Another item that we're told to avoid in 2012 was playing youth soccer. It can permanently damage your brain, as can other sports that involve repeated blows to the head. Mounting evidence shows that the routine hits young athletes that take playing football, soccer, lacrosse, and even volleyball can cause cognitive problems. Girls' soccer players have more concussions than any other young athletes except football players. What's happening in this country is an epidemic of concussions, says sports physician Bob Cantu, who warns that brain injuries can affect some young people for the rest of their lives. Something else to avoid, according to this article in The Week magazine, worrying about everyday problems will shorten your life. A British study found that People who reported feeling even mild anxiety, the sort that distracted them, depleted their self-confidence or occasionally kept them awake at night, were 16% more likely to die over a 10-year period than people with no such concerns. About 1 in 4 people experiences mild anxiety, but most go untreated. Mild stressors, including those surrounding work, finances, and relationships, are so common that they're virtually impossible to avoid. But psychiatrist Glenn Lewis says exercise, meditation, or talk therapy can tame their biological impact. The next thing to avoid, breathing city air raises your risk of heart attack and stroke. After analyzing a decade's worth of data, researchers found that Boston residents were 34% more likely to have a stroke following a day of moderate as opposed to good air quality under Environmental Protection Agency standards. In reality, there is no safe level of air pollution, says Johns Hopkins professor Roger Ping. Inhaling fine particles from car exhaust and power plants can damage the heart and lungs in much the same way cigarette smoking does, by clogging arteries, increasing inflammation, and raising heart rate and blood pressure. And finally, things to avoid, breathing indoor air isn't safe either. Exposure to carbon dioxide, even at levels considered in line with good ventilation, can make you dumber. Researchers tested the reasoning skills of volunteers while exposing them to different levels of CO2 and found that as levels increased, the volunteers' strategic and leadership abilities worsened to a degree so astonishing that it was almost hard to believe, says epidemiologist Mark Mendel. Alarmingly, the highest levels of CO2 that he and colleagues measured, 2,500 parts per million, can easily be found in buildings, including schools, that are in perfect compliance with current ventilation codes. Continuing on in the health and science section, let's look at the big scientific milestones of 2012. The first one was finding the Higgs boson. 48 years after British physicist Peter Higgs predicted its existence, the Higgs boson was finally spotted by scientists at the CERN lab in Geneva. The God particle explains the existence of mass and backs up the Standard Model, the foundational theory of modern physics. For physicists, this is the equivalent of Columbus discovering America, says physicist Thamos Bowcock. The Higgs is evidence that an invisible energy field activated shortly after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, permeates the universe. Without it, all particles would zip chaotically through space, like the massless photons that make up light. The Higgs field slows down certain types of particles, creating stars, planets, and life. The next big milestone of the year was the vital job of junk DNA. Since the late 1990s, when they began decoding the human genome, scientists have believed that 98% of DNA is junk with no function. But new research shows that most of this genetic material serves as switches that turn genes on or off, which could explain why some people predisposed to certain diseases get them, while others don't. Our genome contains at least 4 million switches, and scientists are already linking certain ones to asthma, diabetes, and mental illness. Figuring out what each switch does could lead to new drugs and revolutionize medicine. Says researcher Ewan Burney, it's going to take this century to fill in all the details. The next milestone, Curiosity, explores Mars. NASA's rover made a spectacular landing on Mars in August and started investigating whether the planet has ever been capable of harboring life. Curiosity set off from its landing site on the floor of 3.5-billion-year-old Gale Crater for a 3-mile-high Mount Sharp, giving scientists the fullest picture yet of Mars makeup. So far, the rover's instruments have found proof that water once flowed swiftly across Mars' surface, and the Martian soil contains basaltic materials similar to the volcanic sands of Hawaii. If Curiosity detects carbon, a building block of life, NASA scientist James Green says, we'll have to radically rethink our place in the universe. The next milestone, a new depression drug. A hallucinatory party drug is inspiring the first new treatments for depression in a generation. Ketamine, Special K, as it's sometimes called, clubgoer's choice for a dreamlike high, improves mood disorders by repairing damaged connections in the brain. That discovery, which suggests that depression may be caused not by chemical imbalance but by stress-induced damage to brain cells, represents maybe one of the biggest findings in the field over the last 50 years, says neurobiologist Ron Dumont. Ketamine's negative side effects make it unfit for widespread use, but what it's revealing about how depressed brains work could lead to new and better drugs. And the final item that is considered a milestone for 2012 in the Week magazine, the Arctic's vanishing ice. The Arctic ice cap shrank to its smallest size in recorded history this year. At the rate the ice is disappearing, the Arctic Ocean could be completely ice-free during the summer within just a few decades. Almost a half century sooner than climate models predicted only 5 years ago. What you're seeing is more open ocean than you're seeing ice, says climate researcher Ted Skambos. It just doesn't look like the Arctic Ocean anymore. Climate change is warming the Arctic almost twice as quickly as the rest of the globe. And since the Arctic ice cools polar regions and influences climate patterns for the rest of the planet, its decline could rapidly accelerate the rise of global temperatures. Now, in our review of 2012 from the Week magazine, let's take a look at an online article that just appeared within the last day in the Week magazine. It's entitled, Why 2012 Was Such a Good Year for the Stock Market. The Dow posted its fourth straight year of gains. Apple continued its tear, and more from the year in trading. Stock markets ended 2012 with a bang, with shares climbing on reports that the Senate had reached an agreement to avert the fiscal cliff. The Dow Jones Industrial Average broke a five-day losing streak to climb 166 points on the last trading day of 2012, its best-ever performance on New Year's Eve. The larger S&P 500 posted its biggest final day gain since 1974, and overall 2012 was a good year for stocks. The Dow was up 7.3% for 2012, its fourth straight year of gains. The S&P, or the Standard & Poor's 500, climbed 13%, its best year since 2009, and the tech-heavy NASDAQ index surged 16%. What's behind the stock market's rise? Well, for one thing, the markets are still recovering from their nadirs in 2009 when the country was grappling with the financial crisis. The Dow is up 100.15% since then, the S&P 500 111%, and the NASDAQ 138%. In terms of government policy, investors were heartened by the progress Congress is making on the fiscal cliff. As you remove little bits of uncertainty, investors can then once again return to focusing on the fundamentals, Joseph Tanius, a strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds, tells the Associated Press. In addition, markets were boosted in 2012 by the Federal Reserve's decision to continue supporting the economy with loose monetary policies, as well as the European Union finally getting its arms around a long-running debt crisis. A look at individual companies offers a more nuanced picture of the economy. The Dow's best performers were Home Depot, up 48.5%, and Bank of America, up 107%. Home Depot's big gains came in a comeback year for the U.S. housing market, says Steve Schaefer at Forbes. Bank of America continues its recovery from the housing market crash, and since it's still trading at a lowly $12 per share, some investors think it stands to make further gains in 2013. J.P. Morgan Chase also had a solid year despite a scandal stemming from a massive trading loss, while Disney benefited from its recent acquisition of the Star Wars franchise from George Lucas. Caterpillar and McDonald's ended the year in the red, largely due to slowing growth in China. The Dow's worst performer was Hewlett-Packard, whose stock price dove 44% over concerns that the world's largest PC maker has fallen perilously behind in the new world of tablets and smartphones. Hewlett-Packard also suffered an embarrassing setback when it wrote down $8.8 billion from its acquisition of Autonomy due to improper accounting. And Apple had another banner year in 2012, climbing 31% during the year. However, some investors were disappointed with the results, largely because Apple was up 73% for the year back in September. It felt like the most disappointing 31% jump ever, says Jay Yarrow at Business Insider. And that's the way the stock market looked in 2012. As we reach the end of our program for this review of 2012 in the Week magazine, let's take a look at some quotes from the Wit and Wisdom column here. We can only be said to be alive in those moments when our hearts are conscious of our treasures. And that's a quote from Thornton Wilder, quoted in the Monterey County, California Herald. The man who complains about the way the ball bounces is likely to be the one who dropped it. And that was a quote from football coach Lou Holtz. He was quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Take care to get what you like, or you will be forced to like what you get, says George Bernard Shaw, quoted in the Boston Globe. Power doesn't always corrupt. Power can cleanse. What I believe is always true about power is that power always reveals. And that's a quote from Robert Caro, quoted in CNN.com. And finally, there's only one thing we can be sure of, and that is the love that we have for our children, for our families, for each other. The warmth of a small child's embrace, that is true. And that was a quote from President Obama speaking in Newtown, Connecticut, after the tragedy that occurred in December. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.